Today on Reader's Corner, Scott Patterson, former financial reporter for The Wall Street Journal and author of The Quants, How a New Breed of Math Whizzes Conquered Wall Street and Nearly Destroyed It.
High-frequency trading is said by experts to account for upwards of 70 to 80% of all stock market volume. Firms move in and out of stocks at rates measured in microseconds. And initially, this really experienced a major problem in 2007. Manias and panics and crashes are an old story in the world of speculation, and we're going to see it again. It's inevitable.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The stock market, like all games of risk, is about understanding the odds and bending them to your advantage. In the history of investing, no one applied these principles with more brilliance and hubris than the quants, an elite group of math geniuses who dominated Wall Street from the 1990s to the market's 2007 meltdown. Scott Patterson takes us deep inside their world in his best-selling book, The Quants, How a New Breed of Math Whizzes Conquered Wall Street and Nearly Destroyed It. The book is now out in paperback, and today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Patterson. Following a cast of explosive characters through their formative years, Mr. Patterson shows how such things as quantum physics, code breaking, supercomputers, and gumption turned a bunch of second-class geeks in the trading community into billionaire playboys at the top of the field. But even among their ranks, some insisted there is no free lunch, that the market cannot be beaten. This foresight came brutally to bear, resulting in the ruin of several Wall Street institutions and countless investors who believed in the machine. A former Wall Street Journal financial reporter, Mr. Patterson joins us by phone from New York for this interview. Scott Patterson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, Scott, let's start at the beginning, the quants. First of all, is this your term? Or if I walk down Wall Street and start talking about the quants, is everyone going to know what's going on, even if they hadn't read your book?
No, this isn't my term. This is a well-known term that started to be applied about 20 years ago or so to these guys. Initially, they were actually called rocket scientists. And, you know, that went back to the Apollo program. And that's really kind of the same world that these guys came out of, was the labs at MIT and other really high-tech universities. In the 1970s and 1980s really is when it took off, more and more of these very sophisticated, highly educated mathematicians and computer scientists started showing up on Wall Street desks pricing complex instruments like derivatives. It really took off in the 90s for a number of different reasons. One was computer power became a lot cheaper and a lot more widespread. Another was that the defense industry in the United States started scaling back a lot, and these guys didn't have jobs. So they started looking to see where the best place to work would be, and it turned out to be Wall Street, and it was actually much better paying.
Now, in the old days, investors would look at things like fundamentals of the company and earnings per share and price-to-earnings ratios. That was pretty standard stuff. Back in the 80s, I can remember hanging around Chicago with a lot of these guys, and that was the way they talked. But this became a lot more sophisticated than that.
Right. It definitely became much more sophisticated. One thing that they look at a lot to measure whether to invest in a security or not is something that they call volatility. And volatility is essentially how much a stock, or it could be an option or even a derivative like a credit default swap, tends to move up and down in time. It turns out that volatility is not very easy to measure, especially over long periods of time. It can be very volatile. So that is really the main area where these quants got a foothold in Wall Street. One of the first areas where they started really showing how good they were at measuring volatility was in the stock option market. In 1973, several professors and financial engineers wrote a paper about how to price stock options. It was Myron Scholes, Fisher Black and Robert Merton, who are sort of legendary figures in the quant world now, teamed up on a couple papers that showed how you could actually price a stock option. And actually in the 90s, they won Nobel Prizes for it, although Fisher Black, he died before the Nobel Prize was handed out in 1997, so he didn't receive it. But that shows you how powerful their methodology was, and that was really one of the big places where this took off. And in the 70s, options trading became a very powerful new field for the quants.
So methodology, that's a good way of putting it. That certainly is what they contributed to the eventual meltdown, a new kind of methodology that would be applied. But then on the other side, there's the infrastructure issue. I mean, I assume in the old days, if there's just a small group of guys in New York City working on Dow Jones doing some of these things, it's one thing. But then you point out that when you add the contribution they made in the name of a money grid, now we're talking about the ability to spread this stuff across the globe and to spread it with lightning speed computer assistance. Help us understand right. how that then matches up with the methodology to really bring us to the 2007 meltdown.
Right. Well, there are a lot of different kinds of quants. So one kind that became extremely successful and wealthy starting in the 90s were quants that traded stocks and other securities like options at extremely rapid speeds. So this was a combination of using the formulas that people like Scholes and Black and Merton came up with and the incredible new power of computer trading. This strategy was known as statistical arbitrage, and arbitrage is trading between very similar securities in different places. So if you have gold that is trading for $1,000 in New York and it's $1,050 in London, a quant can set up a very fast trading system to buy it in New York and sell it in London, and you make an instant $50 profit. Of course, it's never really that easy. So what these guys did was they started noticing how very similar stocks would trade at different levels all over the place. Maybe in an exchange in Chicago, that might be at a different level in New York, or maybe even overseas in London. So over the years, they have built this giant computer infrastructure that allows them to trade all around the world at speeds that now boggle the mind. In fact, there's a whole new kind of trading that arose in the past decade called high-frequency trading. And high-frequency trading is said by experts to account for upwards of 70 to 80% of all stock market volume. It's extremely rapid. It's high-frequency. These firms move in and out of stocks at rates measured in microseconds, which is a billionth of a second. So if you can imagine those kinds of speeds, that's what's going on. And initially, this kind of trading first really experienced a major problem in August of 2007, which I write about in the book, when the StatArb hedge funds had a serious meltdown. But there's been others since then as well.
When we consider all of the reform legislation or rules and regulations that has either been proposed or enacted, is there any chance that any of these things that you've just listed would be rolled back? High frequency trading, it seems like once we're there, we're never going back to
right.
those
yeah,
other.
Yeah, I think the genie's out of the bottle with a lot of these things. It's in a way you just have to look at it as, you know, these are the growing pains of a rapidly transforming market and the interaction of technologies that many people don't even understand with that market. It's a very volatile mixture, because one thing that I found with the quant strategies in general is that they depend on the market acting like it had in the past. That's basically what they do, is they use statistics that show how volatile, say, a stock had been over the past 15 or 20 years, and they use that to predict where it's going to go in the future. That's a static model, but the market tends to be non-static, if I could use that word. It tends to be very unpredictable. Things can happen when people get frightened, when fear or greed become a major force on Wall Street. Things aren't quantifiable anymore. And that's where these systems run into trouble. But I think that, at least I hope, that they're learning from their experiences. And what we've just seen in the past 3 or 4 years is a market that was so chaotic and volatile that they now understand, at least, like I said, I hope they do, that it's not as predictable as they once thought. And all of these crazy moves that we've seen now will be input into the model, and it'll make them less aggressive, I think. They'll be a little bit more chastened. They'll realize that things can run off the rails sometime, and they'll use less leverage or borrowed money to make these bets. At least that's what I hope. And sometimes I can be kind of pessimistic about the way Wall Street works. And there, these people can be very short-term oriented, and that's a major problem. Is they may think that everything is fine now. They have figured out a new way, a new infallible way to make money, and just let it roll. And once that happens, we could possibly see all this all over again.
You're listening to Scott Patterson. He's the author of The Quants, How a New Breed of Math Whizzes Conquered Wall Street and Nearly Destroyed It. Well, you basically spend most of your time talking about 9 or 10 guys. You've done like bios on each of them, taking us through this meltdown, through their experience. So now it's all over and we're reconstructing things. How did these 9 guys fare in this thing? And you say that maybe they got the message. I guess the other question I would have for you, are they the ones that are the decision makers in this new era? Or are they the ones that have been cast off to the sidelines a bit by virtue of the fact that either they lost a lot or they're no longer as credible as they once were?
Right. Well, you'd like to hope that when people lose hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, that nobody's going to give them any money anymore. That proves not to be the case.
Right.
Most of the guys that I wrote about are still charging ahead. They still run hedge funds or proprietary trading desks for large banks, and they're all extremely wealthy and fly around in private jets and have giant houses. So it definitely is something that's a bit disheartening, is to see how people who lead these institutions into a massive catastrophic blow up. They seem to have no repercussions. They seem to suffer very little, aside from maybe a little bruised pride. And even that, I've found that they're so arrogant that they really don't accept any responsibility for what happened. They blame others. And in a way, I think that's kind of the mentality of the people that run these things, is it takes a lot of guts and a huge ego to invest billions of dollars. So when something goes wrong for these guys, unfortunately, they don't feel like it was their fault, which kind of makes you wonder if they're going to be, if they're going to make the same mistakes all over again. Mm-hmm. And they are. I mean, they are at the top of the pyramid. The guys that I wrote about in this book are definitely the elite of this world. They run the biggest hedge funds. They run the biggest bank trading desks. They all know each other and talk to one another and exchange ideas. And they, are all plowing right ahead right now.
Well, to the point of their knowing each other, you open up the book telling us about a poker game. And most mm-hmm. of the guys you were talking about have a regular poker game?
Right, yeah. That was one of the more interesting discoveries, is that a number of these quants, who got to know each other through the various circles that they run in at the universities or conferences, and they apparently, for the elite of the elite quants, there is this private poker game that they hold throughout hotels in New York City that requires a minimum $10,000 to sit at the table. Sometimes they actually require $50,000 to sit at the table for the higher stakes games. And they play this, you know, I think once a month. Last I heard, they're still doing it, so they haven't pulled back on that. And it just sort of speaks to the broader mentality of who these people are. They're gamblers, you know. They have a gambling mentality. They don't like to admit that because gambling has a sort of seedy side to it, and they want to portray themselves as scientists who are using very advanced technologies to manage money. But at the end of the day, it's a gamble, and there's no way they can get around it, and they like to gamble. You know, they get a thrill out of it, and that is why they all go to Las Vegas all the time and are into poker and blackjack.
Well, Ed Thorpe, one of the subjects of your book, actually tried to beat blackjack and roulette, as I remember it. Is that correct?
Right. He did beat blackjack, yeah, and roulette. He developed this card counting strategy that became famous and led to the MIT card counting team. Ed Thorpe was a professor at MIT in the late 50s and early 60s, and he'd heard about some attempts that people had made to statistically figure out a methodology to beat blackjack. None of them had done very well. He decided to see if he could do it himself, and he used these IBM supercomputers, at least at the time they were supercomputers at MIT, and he plugged in all sorts of data, and he figured out a very intelligent and actually profitable way to beat blackjack in Las Vegas, and he did test it out and won, and he wrote a book that became famous called Beat the Dealer. And I found that it was sort of a touchstone for a lot of these quants these days. Many of them have read that book, and they've become card counters, and I think they saw it as sort of like training to, you know, to be a quant.
You may not know the answer to this, and I could probably figure it out on my own, given what the way you've described these guys. But I must say that you don't come away from this book with a very good feeling for the value that they've added to the economy. And I don't mean the monetary value, but I mean, mm-hmm, at the end of the day, you look back and wonder, have you made this place a better place to live? And you certainly, right, don't come away with that. Are these guys known for taking any of the vast millions and billions and putting it into not-for-profits and creating opportunities for other people? Or is this pretty much all about reinvesting in their own businesses?
Well, I think that a number of them do give to charity, and they certainly have the money to do so. But beyond that, there actually is a self-justification process for what they do. And so what they claim is that they're making the market more efficient by exploiting the inefficiencies in the market. So if there are two securities that are related and they're trading at different prices, and they invest in those in a way to bring them back to parity, that is making the market more efficient. They claim that this adds to the broader social welfare of the entire world, actually, by making markets more efficient. I have a lot of trouble accepting that argument myself. I personally, you know, think they should leave it to others to try to figure out if they're adding anything to society instead of patting themselves on the back and trying to explain why they're millionaires and get to fly around in jets because they're adding to the market's efficiency. You know, if people were paid well for adding to the broader social welfare, teachers would be driving around in Ferraris. You know, aid workers would be living in mansions. It's a very sort of, distasteful self-justification process that they go through. And I think partially, maybe they feel a little guilty. I mean, I'm not too sure. I don't really like to psychoanalyze them too much, but I think they want to feel like they're adding something. Mm-hmm. And they have come up with this widely shared belief that what they do is broadly helping the economy. And I'm not saying it doesn't. it's a complicated argument. You could say that they're doing something. They're actually making things too efficient. That's kind of a complex argument. But think of it this way: they're trying to maximize the utility of the market and push it to its limit. So imagine a bridge that has a certain capacity, say, 1,000 tons. And what quants would do is they would try to figure out how to get the maximum amount of trucks across a bridge over a certain time period. Basically, what they're doing is they're pushing that bridge to the edge and testing its limits. And sometimes the bridge isn't going to be able to hold all those trucks, and it's going to crack and crumble, and then everybody else is going to pay for it. And I think in a sort of complex way, that's what we saw happen in the past 3 or 4 years.
Every now and then there's an exception to the rule, and you identified toward the end of your book one gentleman by the name of Paul Wilmot, who is that exception in that he's not afraid to criticize his profession. You call him one of the most accomplished quants of them all. And in 2000, you quote him as saying, "It is clear that a major rethink is desperately required if the world is to avoid a mathematician-led market meltdown." So this guy's not predicting what happened in 2007 and 8. He's writing in 2000 predicting what is yet to come. Your take on that?
Right.
That's a little scary.
Right, I know. Well, Wilmot was writing just after, a few years after, a giant hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management had imploded and actually did threaten the global financial system and had to be bailed out by a bunch of banks in an effort led by the Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. Long Term Capital Management at the time was this giant hedge fund that was led by quant traders, including those guys I mentioned earlier in the interview, Myron Scholes and Robert Merton, the inventors of the stock option pricing formula back in the 70s. They were advising the fund, and they were partners in the fund, and the entire fund was based on using very complicated mathematical formulas to invest. And they did sort of what I was telling you about with the bridge. They pushed everything to the limit in terms of leverage and borrowed money. Long-term capital was leveraged beyond belief. It had something to the tune of $100 billion in bets on and only about $4 billion in capital. So if they lost $4 billion of that $100 billion, all their capital was wiped out, and that's what happened in 1998. So we had an example of what Wilmot was talking about, a mathematician-led market meltdown. But he was seeing it from the inside. He was seeing all of these new products that were coming out of Wall Street, and people were coming out of universities, mathematicians and physicists, creating these very complicated products. And it really worried him. He thought that the math wasn't very good. It was too complex. These people don't understand financial markets. They're mathematicians. They understand how computer programs work. Wilmot launched Oxford's financial engineering program in the 90s, so he knew where he was coming from, and he did predict it. He's been trying ever since then to drum into all of these quants a basic understanding of the markets that they work in, and he actually launched his own teaching program to get across his perspective in the hopes that he could offset what he saw coming down the pike, but it turned out that he was too late.
Now, he's over in Britain. Is anybody over here, the regulators, the lawmakers, anybody paying any attention to what Paul Wilmot is saying when it comes to restructuring this system?
Well, I think that, what has happened, everybody's paying attention to it, but it is so complicated, and these products are so opaque that, I think you really do need reform from the inside, from people like Wilmot. One financial engineer that people might have heard of is NYU professor Nassim Taleb, who wrote a book called Fooled by Randomness and another book called The Black Swan, in which he describes in ways similar to what Wilmot does the flaws with a lot of these quant models, one of which is that they do not see big explosive events coming, which Taleb calls a black swan. They essentially just wipe those the possibility of those events out of the model. So Taleb has been going around for the past few years trying to tell people about the flaws in this whole system, and he's actually very extreme. He says just get rid of all the mathematicians and, you know, let financially savvy people run things. You know, I don't think that's realistic. It's not going to happen. Like I said, the genie's out of the bottle. And I think sometimes you do need people who have some mathematical sophistication to manage this money. We're talking trillions of dollars in money. And I think at times it does require a fairly sophisticated approach. Where all of this goes wrong is when people try to get the most profits they possibly can out of the system to drive as many trucks as they can across that bridge and push it to the limit. And, you know, we see this over and over again. Right now, it's not so easy because the banks aren't lending that much money, even though the Fed has dropped the interest rate to barely nothing. But, you know, really, at the end of the day, this is an old human story in a new form. It's interesting because it's math and it's computers, but manias and panics and crashes are an old story in the world of speculation, and we're going to see it again. It's inevitable. It'll have a new form. It probably will have something to do with mathematicians and computers because, in my perspective, that is Wall Street now, and they're becoming more and more pervasive. And despite their claims to be able to manage risk in ways that we've never seen before, that only, often, such as the example with long-term capital management, leads to more risk-taking.
I noticed in your acknowledgments that you gave credit to a couple of people, two or three people, for the interviews they gave you, the insights they provided you. But sounds to me like you may have been a little frustrated in getting these other guys on record or to talk to you, or did you just assume it didn't make any sense to do that anyway? I'm thinking of people like Ken Griffin at Citadel. Did you get to guys like that?
Right. I talked to everybody in the book, except for Jim Simons, who runs Renaissance Technologies, which is the most secretive of all hedge funds. So I wasn't too surprised. And I didn't write a lot about Simons anyway. But everybody else, you know, I did speak with. Some of them I had agreements with that I wouldn't acknowledge that I had spoken with them. But you can just assume by what I'm saying that I did. So, you know, it was very tough. These aren't always guys that want to speak.
I guess.
Especially in 2008 when the market was melting down. And in 2009, I mean, Ken Griffin, who was the manager of Citadel Investment Group and still is, that hedge fund lost something like $6 billion in 2008. So you can imagine why Ken wouldn't be too eager to sit down with somebody who's writing a book about his hedge fund. But he did. He did ultimately meet with me face-to-face, and we met in the Four Seasons Hotel in New York City, actually.
Well, Scott, we've run out of time, but I really do appreciate your coming onto the show, and thanks a lot for the book. It's called The Quants, How a New Breed of Math Whizzes Conquered Wall Street and Nearly Destroyed It, by Scott Patterson. Scott, thanks so much for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Scott Patterson. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Aaron Ryan. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.